Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Memorial Day doorbuster deals are here at Lowe's. Right now, rewards members save $80 on the Master Forge 4-burner gas grill, now just $149. Plus, rewards members save $900 on the Lowe's exclusive Hisense French door refrigerator, now only $999. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 5/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Programs subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to The Smiley Show. I am Charlie Hume. I'm doing a bit of solo duty at the moment as Smiley Kaufman is in the midst of a hard-earned vacation. At the moment, somewhere tropical. The man has been traveling all over the United States for the better part of this year, broadcasting golf, giving you commentary here on The Smiley Show. And it's time. It's time for him to enjoy a little bit of well-deserved time off alongside Francie and Anna Carter. So I'm happy that they're doing that. Today, we have a conversation he recorded before heading on vacation with Jason Duffner. It is a fantastic conversation. As a fly on the wall, I loved every bit of this. So let me just set this up with the help of our friends from Ahead. And today's headline from Ahead is trust-based relationships. Ahead builds and manages digital platforms that power the most successful organizations in the world. Their consultative approach, unmatched engineering, and innovative solutions combine to accelerate the impact of technology in every client they serve. Ahead's longstanding relationships are built on outcomes and experience with both their clients and technology partners. You can learn more at ahead.com. Here's what we got for you with Duffner today. We have some chipping tips, some short game tips, like keep a wedge nearby because you're going to want to, as I did, listen to what Jason's saying, work on some grip stuff, work on some wrist angle, you know, things like that. Just listen and try to learn. It will help you. I promise it's already made an impact on my short game. He's going to talk a little bit about going through some mental struggles. He and Smiley both sort of aligned on that and talked about, you know, what they learned through that process, the way they've worked on that. Really helpful for anyone who's trying to master the mental side of the game. And then, of course, he's Jason Duffner. He's got plenty of amazing stories in the game of golf from just, you know, things from his playing career, but also some funny stuff alongside fellow players. So lots to unpack here. You're going to want to listen or watch every minute of this interview. I'm no longer going to filibuster. I'm going to hand this right off now to Smiley and Jason Duffner. Hope you enjoyed this conversation.
All right, welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. Have an incredible guest on here today, Jason Duffner. Duff, super excited about having you on. Just saw you recently down in Auburn at your foundation event. Of course, you guys have done incredible work in the community in Auburn. Just tell us a little about the foundation, all the work you have done, and how much money you've raised.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I did the No Laying Up podcast, so this is my second podcast. It's very few and far between for me on podcasts and
come on
these types of things. But the tour players are always good at scratching each other's backs, and I appreciate you taking the time last week.
No, of course, man. I love supporting
our foundation, and it's the least I could do to grab this time to hop on the podcast and talk about golf and talk about some other stuff. But yeah, the foundation is locally based here in Auburn, been about almost 15 years. And our big mission is food insecurity. So what we do is obviously we raise money, and I run my own program. So we don't really donate to other programs. And all the money that we raise goes right here to the kids in Lee County. So we pack on Thursdays. I got a wonderful group of volunteers. mostly retirees. We have a lot of people that have come back to Auburn. A lot of times they went to school here, went off and worked and did other things in life, and then have decided to retire. So I've got a great group of volunteers that pack on Thursdays. And then we give out food for the weekends, first through fifth grade. Free or reduced lunch is how you qualify. And, you know, we got some non-perishable goods in these bags for these kids to take home on the weekends, usually like oatmeals and canned vegetables, canned fruits, and snacks, and all these things. So it's been really nice to be able to use the platform I have, and people recognize what I did in the game of golf to kind of give back to the local community.
Yeah, you're definitely a legend in Auburn. You could see that, especially anytime I'm at your event in Auburn. We're driving down. You have a road named after you in Auburn, too, correct?
Yeah, I think it's a parking lot right
now. It's a parking lot right now.
It's over at Moores Mill. Yeah, so the community's been great to me. We love living here. I've been here full time since 2002. Obviously, I went to school here for 95 to 2000. So it's been a great time here in Auburn, and the community is very supportive of what I do and supporting me throughout my career.
Yeah, Duff, how did you end up in Auburn? Because I know you weren't born in the Auburn area or Alabama for that matter. So how you ended up there, you walked on the team, right?
I did, yeah. I got a little bit of a late start in golf. I played a lot of other sports growing up as a kid. Sports were a big thing in my household. My grandfather actually played baseball for the White Sox for a little bit. The baseball was huge. My dad was a big basketball guy. He walked on, played for about a year at Kent State. So sports were always a part of our lives. They played golf casually. You know, I knew about golf. I would go to the driving range. We had an executive course, you know, like a little 9-hole, mostly par threes, maybe a par four, par five in there. And I would do that just kind of in the summer times because that's what my grandfather and my dad did, right?
Yeah.
But I never really got serious till we moved. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, so you only really had this summertime months to play. But I really didn't get serious till I moved to South Florida when I was 15 and just started you know, I moved from Cleveland to South Florida and it's hard to fit in. And, you know, in high school, like everybody's got their, yeah. And kids already have their cliques when you're starting kind of in the ninth grade. So, I kind of trended towards golf because I could do it alone. I could do it by myself. I didn't need friends to do it. We were members at a golf club, Weston Hills, which is where they had the Honda Classic for about 4 or 5 years. So I got to see these guys once a year up close and in person, and it just kind of developed from there. But, you know, I didn't play a lot of junior golf. I probably started playing junior golf right around the summer of my junior year. So in between junior and senior year.
Jeez.
I think my first AJGA event, national event, was the summer of my senior year after I had already graduated. Holy. So that's kind of late on the radar for, you know, going to college and thinking that you can play in college and being recruited. I actually qualified for the Pub Links that summer.
Okay.
After. So, you know, I was starting to have some good success and felt like I could play Division I golf. And just pick some schools. I really wanted to go to Florida because I had friends that were going to Florida. But Coach Alexander at the time told me he doesn't take on walk-ons and he didn't have a qualifier. So,
which, of course, Buddy now is, of course, you know, volunteer assistant at Auburn. And it's a big part of the program for the men's and women's teams there.
Reminded him multiple times of that I would have loved to have been a Gator. But
he coached my parents at LSU.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I looked there. That wasn't going to work. I looked at FSU. I looked at Clemson. And I looked at Auburn. And, you know,
you just kept on going north until you found a D1 program that would take you.
And I need to find a school that I could get accepted to without the, you know, athletic department help. So Auburn accepted me. We came and visited. The program was a good program. They actually had 4 guys leaving. That year, that kind of was part of the reason why I felt like I could come in and compete as long as I had a good week of walking on, I guess you could call it, in the qualifying. So yeah, I got to campus and I was just a regular student. I lived in the dorms. There was an empty field, which is now like the nursing school building off of campus. And I would literally go to class in the morning. Sometimes I would miss class, but I would literally hit balls in that field and shag my own balls. I didn't have a car when I first got to school. So I just kind of figured it out, and that's how it went, and figured out when the qualifier was for walking on. And I think I borrowed like somebody's car in the dorm and gave them like $20 or something ridiculous and said, hey, you know, can I borrow your car this afternoon? I need to go over to Indian Pines, which is where the qualifier was, which is over by the airport. And I ended up, I hadn't played a round of golf since I had been on campus for probably maybe 6 weeks or something like that. And I ended up shooting 66. So I'm like, okay,
that was enough.
That was pretty good. And then, you know, it was a 2 or 3 round qualifier. I can't remember. And I get back to my dorm and I'm doing whatever you do when you're in college as a freshman. I get a phone call and it's Coach Griffin, who was the men's coach at the time. And he's like, hey, I'm looking for Jason Duffner. And I'm like, this is him. And he's like, hey, I was wondering, are you shot 66 in the qualifier today for walk-on? I was like, yes, sir. And he's like, okay, well, I need to verify that with some of the guys to make sure like it's legit. And if it is, you don't have to do the qualifier anymore. And I'd like for you to come practice with the team. I think that was like on a Friday or something. And they had practice and they played 9 holes on Saturday. So I show up on Saturday. I think I bummed another car ride somehow, some way over there. And he put me with the guys that were the best on the team at that time. He's like looking for verification, right? And we played 9 holes and I shot 33 for those 9 holes. So, you know, and that's just kind of how it started. So everybody's story is a little different. But you know, I just felt like I was always a competitor. I played sports. I competed. Maybe I was a little late in the game with golf, but, you know, that's just kind of how it worked out for me.
Did Coach Griffin put you on scholarship pretty soon after your freshman year? Were you making the lineup that freshman year?
Yeah, so I played in the first tournament.
Wow.
That was in the fall. I think they had one event, like, at the end of the fall that I was on the team, but then I didn't go. And then I finished second in the qualifier for the spring, and I went to Hawaii, first event, finished 10th, and played a significant amount for my 4 years. I didn't get scholarship obviously that first year, and then I think the second year I might have gotten some scholarship, but my grades were pretty questionable, so there was like, is he even going to be here type of thing. And I think my second year I was on books, but then my last handful of years, I was here 5 years. I redshirted my 4th year because I needed to finish school. And that was the deal with my parents, is like, you need to graduate before you can play professional golf. So I think the last couple of years, obviously I had some type of scholarship, but
I mean, shoot, you get to Auburn in 95 and then all of a sudden in 2001, you have nationwide tour status. And I'm just looking, you know, from 2001 to 2006, with one of those years having status on the PGA Tour in 2004. What do you remember most about that span of time? Because, you know, you're coming off a college of, 90. I mean, it wasn't too long ago where you're just now playing your first AJGA event. Now you're playing in a qualifier where you didn't play for 6 weeks. And somehow 4 years later, you're playing professional golf.
Yeah, I had a decent college career. I won a couple times. I was an All-American a couple times, All-SEC. But it wasn't a sure thing. And the thing that's weird about golf is anybody can turn pro, right? You don't really know how it's going to go. Obviously, the guys that are All-Americans and those high-ranked players, people think are going to be part of the tour, but I certainly wasn't one of those guys. But, you know, I set out to be a professional. I rounded up some money. My parents gave me some money. I had some friends in town that gave me some money. I started with about $30,000. And I went and played the Golden Bear Tour, which was a summer professional tour. It was in Palm Beach. Yeah,
Palm
we played
Beach.
we played all those courses down and around Jupiter. Our tour championship was at the Bears Club, which had just opened.
Sick.
So yeah, it was one of those things where it was like a whole summer. You wrote a check for X amount of dollars. And it's pretty much organized gambling is what it is. Everybody's paying about $1,000 a week. There's some fees taken out for running the tournament. Mm-hmm. And you're just seeing kind of where you stack up and how you stack up and trying to make some more money so you can keep going. And obviously back then the Q school was a big thing in the fall. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went down there and I had some success. I played well. I didn't win, but I was making money and I actually was able to kind of bankroll that into continuing to play on the mini tours. My first go around at Q school, I think I got through first stage, but I didn't make past second. So you kind of find other tournaments around to go play. We'd play some in Jacksonville in the winter and Atlanta in the spring. And then I planned to go back down to South Florida in 2001. And you'd get off weeks. So every time you got an off week, maybe you'd go chase a qualifier, you know, if you could. So I ended up Monday qualifying for an event in Hershey, Pennsylvania on the what is now the Corn Ferry Tour on an off week early in the Golden Bear season that year in the summer. And I finished like, I think, 12th or so. Mm-hmm. And back then, top 25 got you in the next one. And the next one was in Wichita. So I packed my bags and went to Wichita and ended up winning the second Corn Ferry. I think it was buy.com back then. Event, and that gave me status. So, you know, from there, you're just going with it. I almost got my card. I think they took, 15 or so that year that I played to the tour, and I ended up finishing 20th with about half of the season played. So I felt good about it. The next 2 years were a bit of a struggle. I ended up keeping my card, but I wasn't close.
Yeah.
To, you know, making it on tour. And then 2003, I had a big year. I think I finished about fourth or fifth on the money list. And 04 was my first year on tour.
So I think most people, when they think of Jason Dufter and just your overall game, you think about just like elite ball striking. And I want to kind of talk about the beginning part of your career, which you just talked about. You know, I read that in 2007, you had hired Chuck Cook. So before that time, before you had hired Chuck, how would you describe your game? Was it a lot of the same? Were you a really good ball striker? Or maybe were there some areas that were a little bit better back then before kind of everybody got to know the Jason Dufter that we, you know, you watch week in and week out?
Yeah, I think my ball striking was always the strongest part of my game throughout the entirety of my career. I was able to have a pretty simple swing that could manage the pressure of what you're trying to do in that moment. That swing that I played with for a long time produced results under pressure. So the ball striking was always really good. I needed to get better at short game stuff, which Chuck helped me a lot with. Also understanding tendencies in my golf swing. I could be very streaky at times in those early years of a professional, but he gave me some really simple things that I could cue on so that if things got off, I could get back on track pretty quick. And the other thing that Chuck really helped me with him being involved with Tom Kite and Payne Stewart and Corey Pavin, is just learning how to be a professional. Learning how to practice and prepare and, you know, have these good routines and habits that would produce good play on the PGA Tour. And that's what he helped me most with, was just these little things that people that aren't in the professional world maybe don't quite understand. But that really helped me elevate my game, because I always had, you know, a nice tool set with the ball striking, clean up some of the short game stuff. I'll be honest with you, I never really worried about my putting. I didn't even care about it. And, you know, that's kind of reflective.
Because you hit it good enough?
Yeah, I always felt like there would be enough weeks that, you know, I could putt well. And I'll be honest, when I took a dive to improve my putting, I got a lot worse. It's like I found out like how bad I was and became self-conscious about it, you know, later in my career. When I was playing full time, I even had the yips. Like, you know, I'd be deathly afraid of 20-inch putts out there, and that was something hard. But, you know, when I went down that rabbit hole of understanding the putting, I got really bad. So, but I think, you know, Chuck was a great part of my career and my life, and he really helped me with some of the physical stuff, just understanding, you know, my patterns and my habits, yeah. But just how to be a professional, how to prepare, how to manage all these things that are uncomfortable with being a PGA professional.
Was the waggle something that was always there from day one with you? Just the, you know, loosening up the hands. Did you learn that? You know, was that something you read and you're like, oh, I'm going to try that out. Is that always,
I think,
been there?
For me, I played a lot of baseball growing up. So when I was in the batter's box, the bat was always moving, right? I didn't like to be stationary. In baseball, you're kind of moving around. And then all of a sudden you get in that set position, right? You're waiting for the pitcher, yeah, and his delivery. So the bat was always moving and I'm always moving. And that felt comfortable for me. So in golf, if you watch, I'm waggling, I'm moving my feet. I think that's part of the reason I've struggled with the putting, is because that's a very static positioning. You know, I've tried to, like, you see guys tap the putter or raise, mm-hmm, the putter, but mm-hmm, you watch, like, Patrick Cantlay's always moving his feet when he's doing it, right? But I've always been so static with my putting, and I think that's been a difficult transition to, like, figure some of that out. But there's nothing like, it's not the same amount every time. There's no, like, pre-shot feel. I think it's just that part of me that wants to be athletic in that moment.
Taking a quick break from Smiley's conversation with Jason Duffner to talk to you about ShipStixx. ShipStixx gets you from your front door to four easier than ever. They'll pick up your golf clubs from your home or office and deliver them on time, guaranteed to your golf destination anywhere in and outside the United States. No more airport headaches, no more lugging heavy bags, just easy, stress-free travel for golfers like you. Ton of supporting benefits involved with ShipStixx: white glove service, complimentary insurance, real-time tracking, door-to-door service, international shipping, and it's for any occasion. It's perfect for buddies' trips, business trips, even family vacations where managing kids, strollers, and extra luggage can ruin your vacation before it's even begun. Fun fact for everyone listening at this moment in time, you're listening to this midweek, and I am hopefully playing a golf course that is at the top of my bucket list that I cannot wait to share with you the next time Smiley and I record. And how did I get my clubs there? I use ShipStixx to get my clubs to this destination, because what's worse than going to a bucket list course and being so excited to play it and then having to use a loaner set? That's not fun for anybody. It's not fun for me. So big thanks to ShipStixx for getting my clubs there on time, and cannot wait to tell you about that experience on the back end. But you can enjoy your 20% off your next shipment, your ShipStixx shipment. Say that 20% times fast by using the promo code Smiley, SMYLIE. And we'll also put a link in the YouTube description at the bottom there where you can just click that and ship your clubs wherever they need to go. So check out ShipStixx. We appreciate the support of the show, and let's get you back to Smiley's conversation with Jason Duffner.
So when we talk about the yips, I've always had this debate with players that have struggled with their game, whether it's this, the golf swing, or it's the chipping or the putting. For you, the putting, like me, ball striking. I've always argued, for me, that I always felt technique-wise was the reason why I had, like, mental struggles with the golf game. I felt like my technique was bad, and it led to mental issues that I would have with the game. For you with the putting, Duff, do you think that it was more so technique, like you kind of just recently talked about? Maybe the stroke wasn't quite as good as you thought, and that led you to feeling like, oh gosh, this is now a mental battle, because you're building scar tissue of, hey, this is the miss and the stroke pattern that I want to avoid.
Yeah, so I actually have done personally a deep dive on that, and then I've spoken to some people, and I finally found a guy that's in the golf space now. His name's Jason Kuhn. I'm sure you're familiar with the name. He worked with Lucas Glover. I spent some time with Jason. I probably
Marine
found
Sniper,
him.
Sniper, right?
That's right. He used to be a pitcher that had the yips, and then joined the Marine Corps and was Navy SEAL sniper. And so he kind of hit the nail on the head for me. I do think that it becomes it starts as a technical issue. But what happens is because you have these failures, mm-hmm, and I think it only happens to certain types of people. If you're fairly self-conscious and you kind of, like, care about what other people think a little bit, or it's embarrassing and these things happen, it'll flare on you, right? And what happens, and Jason agrees with this, and I came to the same conclusion, is your subconscious kicks in, right? And your subconscious says, hey, remember last time we were in this situation and this was painful? Not, I mean, it could be an injury, right? Mm-hmm. You could have a technical issue because of an injury that's painful, or it could be emotionally painful or mentally painful or embarrassing. Your subconscious kicks in and you go right into that flight mode, fight or flight, right? So, you know, I think I had a technical issue that led to poor putting, that eventually turned into scar tissue in whatever way, mentally, probably not physically with my putting, but definitely mentally and emotionally. That your subconscious, that's a natural thing. Your subconscious is constantly telling you in life, hey, be careful about this, be careful about that. It doesn't know that putting or driving isn't life-threatening, but it knows that it's pain, that the situation has been painful. So it is warning you, and you can either go into the flight mode, which is what I went into for a while, or you can fight, right? And that's what they train. And that's where Jason developed his kind of protocols, is through, when you're in the military, they teach you to override that flight mode and you go right to the fight. So he actually helped me a good bit. I'm not near as feel much better with my putting than I ever have. I wouldn't say it's great by any standards, but at least now I don't take a long time to actually pull the putter back and have all these kind of yippy situations. And, you know, it'd probably be something I deal with my whole career, but now I have different ways of managing it. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The word yip, I think, is just a word that no athlete ever wants to speak. They want to talk about it. And I think when you and I spoke, this is back in Napa, I would say probably 2 or 3 years ago, and you openly were talking about it. For me, it struck a chord in that it's like, okay, I've been in the same shoes of, okay, the subconscious stuff, the fight or flight, the embarrassment, all the things you just talked about is what I've 1000% dealt with. But I don't think I was quite as open about using that word. When did you finally feel comfortable
I think that's one thing that Jason says. It is what it is, right? I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's not something that I'm embarrassed about. It's a natural response in human behavior, in human life, to have your subconscious remind you of these things. We're just happening to perform on, you know, these stages that are very elevated and the stakes are high. So I think anytime that I've been around somebody or I know somebody that is struggling with these things, I encourage them to talk about it openly, because then that reduces kind of the stigma that is associated with it in your subconscious. Your subconscious doesn't have a perception of reality. It only knows what you tell it, right? And however you make the situation. That's a big thing that Jason talked to me about, is you can rewire that and you can untrain these uncomfortable situations. So like one of the things that I've done when I'm competing is, if I feel yippy on a stroke and I missed it, I'll go and rewire that to where I actually make it with a confident stroke in my mind, so that it doesn't sit in my subconscious as like, this is something to be afraid of, right? It doesn't know what happened and what didn't happen. It only knows what you tell it. If that makes sense.
It, you know, for me, it's that first, you know, bad driver that I hit, it just hangs out. And I'm trying to picture the million good drives that I've hit the day before on the range.
It only remembers the one.
It just only remembers the one. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, it's crazy how quickly your body does not want to respond to what is good. Yeah. And you just, and your balance and your rhythm, everything just is so bad.
There's a bunch of, you need to, you know, when you're doing it, there's a lot of self-talk you need to do. I'm sure with you, and it's a little different with putting, but I'm sure the anticipation of the first tee shot was just like miserable. Like you're going from the putting green to the first hole.
I just want nobody to be there.
And
I want
to just scenarios, you know? So for me, it would be as soon as the ball hits the green, you can start to feel the change. Right. Or if you miss the green, you're like, oh shit, I better chip this really close, right? That type of stuff.
We can laugh about it, but it's a nightmare.
It's no place to play the PGA Tour. I can promise you that. I could hide it a little bit because the ball striking can really, you know, you can have good results with good ball striking. But for you, if you can't get off the tee, that's like the whole start.
It helps to not be hitting three or five from the tee. Yeah.
I can two putt a lot and still put up decent scores.
Yeah.
Because my ball striking would be good enough.
I thought this was something so interesting too. When we had this conversation a couple of years back, you talked a lot about dry firing. So not hitting any contact.
That's another one of his that I got from him. So you are trying to rewire the connection between the mental and the physical of what you want the stroke to feel like, right? So no results. Like if I'm training that, I'll just hit into the baseboard in the basement or into like, you know, those plane boards they have that are on the ground.
Yeah. So the ball's not rolling anywhere. There's no results.
I'm literally rolling the ball like 8 inches. And then it hits the board and it comes back to me because you're just trying to rewire what the mechanical motion feels like to where that yip or whatever that is that's happening is gone, so that your mind and your body understand that that's not part of the action anymore. So with a driver, you would probably tee up a driver and half swing it into a net, making that contact feel perfect in back. Mm. Right.
Were you able to, you know, go through these scenarios, though, to where you could create some sort of fight or flight scenario in your head of like walking to the green, picturing yourself being there?
That's a hard one.
You know what I'm saying? Because like, how can you simulate your body feels and like how to control? Did you discover anything with your stroke, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Not really. It's really you have to be in that moment, in that environment. And use these tools is the phrase for them to overcome it. You know, I think going into fight mode, which he's very specific about what that is and how to accomplish that, being open with it, like telling yourself, hey, one of the things that I would tell myself is like, hey, I appreciate you warning me that this could be dangerous. But I'm going to choose freedom in this moment, and it's only a 3 foot putt, and nothing drastically is going to happen to me.
Like you're like a bear is not going to come out of the woods and tackle you for missing it.
No. So, you know, you have this self talk you're doing a lot to override these feelings and then to change the, you know, whatever you call it when you're trying to perform an action, to change the motor control, more or less.
Is there any books that you read during this period of time that you think that would be helpful to the audience that are people that are golfers that have dealing with the same things that you and I are talking about? Or a podcast or anything?
I would try and find anything that you can find from Jason Kuhn. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I did pay him, and I do endorse him, but he really helped me understand. And he was the first person that I spoke to or the first thing that I saw that resonated like, hey, that's how I feel. That's what I think is happening. You know, to me, that was game changing for me.
Yeah.
And I had some better results. I started talking to him in the fall of 2023, but that was pretty much my last full year on tour.
Right.
But, you know, I played last year and for me, I just want clean, like, make or miss, whatever. I just don't want to feel that, you know, in my stroke and feel that anxiety and that anticipation of whatever's about to happen. And I would say that significantly has diminished So we'll see in 2 years when I'm competing on Champions Tour how I feel about it. But he's definitely giving me more tools in my toolbox to manage that.
Yeah, the last thing I'm going to kind of talk about with this subject is some advice that I had gotten in this this whole realm of conversation is to try to create what would be called maybe new experiences as a player. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is so for instance, for me would be a totally different swing feel, or example, another one would be like Lucas Glover going from a regular putter to a long putter. This is a totally different experience for your mind and body, right, to like relearn how to do something that seems so foreign, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot too. I think in putting, it's pretty easy. You could go conventional, cross-handed, claw, mid-length, long length. You have lots
of options. Did you try any of those options?
I like the mid-length, and yeah, then I've gone claw some. So I played 2 weeks ago, and I had been punt cross-handed, standard length. And then for whatever stupid reason on Friday, probably because it's alternate shot and I have a partner and I don't want to, you know, look like an idiot, I just didn't feel good. So I was like, whatever, I'm going to go to claw. And I went to claw and managed it, right? So
good.
Just another tool in the toolbox.
Yeah,
I think I got PGA coming up, and I've worked with some of the stats guys, and I really putted probably my best when I was at that mid-length putter mm-hmm. length. So I've been standard, but I think I'm going to go back to the mid-length, about 38 inches.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an option. It will change the feel. It will change the experience, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Until you have bad experiences with the mid-length. But hopefully I have better ways of managing that now.
So 2023, just talked about first time you worked with him. So a decade before that, you're winning a PGA Championship at Oak Hill in 2013. What was that week like? As we're, of course, it's going to be PGA Championship week, like you just spoke about. But were you battling the putting woes during that time? Like, did you win a major championship literally with your whatever game on the greens?
Yeah, I would say it was the beginning. Like, it was in there. I could make strokes, but I could make decent strokes and make putts. It probably wasn't like a red line 9 out of 10 like it's been at times. It was mm-hmm. probably maybe a 5 or a 6. And that's why if you see some of the videos, I'm over these like putts. All these putts look a lot shorter on TV, by the way. Nobody realizes that. Like, that's a fact. Like, I know what 5 feet is. And then when I see it on TV, I'm like, dang, that looks like 20 inches. But they look a lot shorter on TV because of the angle that they're grabbing them on. But there are, you know, you can watch the videos and see that I'm a little bit stuck in my routine. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have a quicker routine. But when you're in that situation, it's hard to pull the water back. So I think it had kind of started that year, actually, in 2013, for whatever reason, and then had flared to significantly worse levels. But, you know, I really had a really nice week, obviously, at the PGA. I would say a very good golf course for me at the time. I haven't played mm-hmm. it since the redo. But that course did not have an advantage for the longer hitter even back then. So everybody more or less had to play from the same position. Now I may be hitting driver and other guys may be hitting fairway woods or long irons, but we were hitting from the same spot more or less on that golf course. So a good golf course for me. We had gotten a lot of rain that week, which was also mm-hmm. beneficial for me because I've always been a little bit of a low ball hitter. So the golf course played soft, and that was an advantage for me, I thought. It also made the fairways wider for me because it was softer. So, and I was coming in that week playing good. I think I finished fourth the week before at Firestone. Yeah. So you're feeling good. The second round, I ended up shooting a 63. We all have these days in our careers, or even just in our golfing life, where everything seems to go right. Mm-hmm. That happened to be the second round of the PGA and not the Tuesday back home with the boys type of thing, if that makes sense, right?
It's a good time for it. It's a good time for it.
You get these days where the numbers are good, you're seeing mm-hmm. things well, good things are happening. Maybe the shots you miss aren't as bad as they could have been on different holes, these things.
Right.
And that really helped me for the week. You shoot 7 under at a major. I think I shot two under the first day. So it really gave me advantage on the field, if that makes sense, to shoot a low score like that.
Because you can just wear them out, just hitting fairways and greens on the weekend.
Yeah. And on Sunday, I hit a lot of shots close. But what people don't realize is like perfect numbers, right? Like I have like 138 on the fifth hole. I have 138. Like that's just basic pitching wedge for me, right? And I can attack and I hit it to like this. And then the eighth hole, I have like 105, which is like perfect number for a sand wedge. And I hit it like this. And then 16, I had like 104. And
it's amazing when you have perfect numbers, man. That's how it always works on this good day.
Perfect wind conditions and all these things. There wasn't much wind that day. So, but all those things lined up. And obviously, I was a good player at that point in time. I think I was in the top 30 in the world. And I had won some events and I had been in the PGA final group a couple of years before. I had finished, I think, fourth at the US Open that year and about 20th at the Masters. So, you know, things were lining up for me. I think that period of time was probably my best golf. I would say most careers on the PGA Tour are about 10 years. And in there, you have about 2 to 3 years of really good stuff. And my stuff really kind of peaked at the middle of 11 and kind of went through to the end of 13.
Mm-hmm. And just asking for a friend, do you know how many beers fit in the Watermaker Trophy?
I can't remember the number because I can't drink that many beers anymore. I've got a young son. Yeah, these young kids ruin your drinking.
Hey, he's got a good golf swing too, man.
Yeah. I haven't taught him anything. He likes to hit golf balls. I wish it was a different sport. We'll see.
Taking one last break here in Smiley's conversation with Jason Duffner to talk to you all about Magic Mind. I've got it right here. If you're watching on YouTube, I've got the mental performance shot that I start my day with every day in my left hand. This is hard when the camera's mirrored. And the sleep performance shot in my right hand. This is the new Charlie Hume and Smiley Kaufman daily regimen. Also, they have some nice mental performance gummies as well that we've been using. And aligns well with this conversation Smiley's having with Jason Duffner. A lot of these are the mental things they talk about. The best way to process those is with a clear mind. And you can do that with the help of Magic Mind. I'll say for myself, it's helped a ton in the golf game. There have been some days where, listen, some of us, many of us are parents chasing around little kids, not getting a ton of sleep. You're waking up, you're lagging a little bit behind your usual pace. And for me, rather than jumping to some caffeine that gets me a little jittery on the golf course, I've been taking these Magic Mind mental performance shots in the morning. And it's been great. It's a nice, calm, steady energy, keeps you focused, but doesn't make you feel like you're gripping tightly on a roller coaster that you cannot control when you get off that thing, as too much caffeine sometimes can do to me. So definitely worth checking out Magic Mind, whether it's just everyday use for work or it's trying to play a little better golf. It helps both. I can attest to that. So check them out at magicmind.com. It's been really good to both Smiley and I. So we encourage you all to check it out as well and improve your daily routine. Let's get you back to Smiley's conversation with Jason Duffner.
Well, you know what? You've been a friend to so many players on the PGA Tour, but you've also been a bit of a mentor slash kind of second eye for a lot of players on the PGA Tour. What is that process and how gratifying has it been to help other players that are just looking for someone that understands cause and effect with golf swings or whatever it may be that they're trying to get a little bit of advice from?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of an interest of mine. That's probably the thing I like most about golf is the mechanical aspect. Like, how do we make this golf ball do X, Y, or Z? And I've studied a lot about it. I've watched a lot of different things. Obviously, you know, the way life is now with YouTube and books and all these things you can get your hands on, right? And, you know, it's nice when guys ask me X, Y, and Z, but I'm not a professional. Like, I try to make it, you know, pretty basic because, like, these guys have careers. Like, what if I'm wrong? Which I'm sure I've been wrong at times. I think the hardest thing for teaching is tour players are really good at putting the sweet spot on the ball, no matter how they need to do it. And I think those patterns are really hard to change, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when guys come up to me for help, I want to see like, hey, what you do when you are really going, right? And then if there's adjustments to make from that, I think I can diagnose that really quick. I think you can, when you're dealing with tour players, you can get into some problems when you start to, you know, go with like swing theory and certain patterns and all these things. You know, Scottie Scheffler's obviously playing amazing the last couple of years, and you could argue him at Rory number one in the world, whatever. But you wouldn't say that Scottie Scheffler has the most mechanically sound golf swing.
No.
But he's really, really good at putting the sweet spot on the ball continually, right? And understanding how far the golf ball goes and these things. So you would never come in as a teacher and try to change that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you have to watch yourself, especially with tour players, about changing too much.
Yeah.
I think you want to find guys like, show me stuff when you're really good. If we can get 3D of it, like the gear stuff.
Yeah.
Now you can really see things that have changed. But I try to keep it simple, try to give them some confidence. The short game stuff you can play around with a lot because that's really easy to learn and change.
So I talked to Michael Johnson, who played his golf at Auburn, an All-American there, a great player playing on the Corn Ferry Tour. I texted him because he'll often just like randomly say, yeah, you know, when I was at Auburn, Duff taught me this shot. And I texted him before this and say, hey, what should I ask Duff in this interview? And Michael said, you need to ask him about Vijay Singh. And I was like, Vijay Singh? He said, why? He's like, well, he used to play like a bunch of practice rounds with him, and he's got a ton of stories about Vijay and about all of the things that he used to try around the greens. I mean, was it ridiculous?
Yeah, it was pretty silly what he did. So I was a rookie in 2004, which was the year Vijay won 10 events.
Yeah.
Before that season started, I was down in Jacksonville in the winter of 2003. And I had always followed Vijay when I was in college. I went to the event in Firestone, and like, for whatever reason, I just saw this guy and I was like, oh, I'm going to check him out. And then I'd watch him play. And like, he was kind of my guy when I was in high school and college. We used to have the event out here at Callaway Gardens in college. We'd go out there. I'd go watch Vijay. So I got my card 2003. Yeah. I was in Jacksonville. He's on the range, and you know, DJ's supposed to be like, don't poke the bear type of guy.
He's
like,
a tough cookie. He's a tough cookie.
I just went up to him. I was like, hey, you know, I'm Jason Duffner. I'm going to be on tour next year. I said, I used to, you know, watch you at Firestone and the Honda Classic and the Buick event. And like, you know, you're pretty much like my guy. You know, if I could ever play a practice round with you or whatever, that'd be great. And, you know, he's kind of like, oh, you know, he's like, oh, that's nice. And then he's like, all right, I'm going to practice. I'm like, okay. I'm like, guess we're not playing a practice round ever. Cool. So I was down there for like a month. And every time I would beat Vijay to the practice facility in the morning, and I would stay until he left. So then like after about 2 or 3 weeks of that, he finally comes over to me and he's like, hey, bro, here's my number. Everybody was bro. He's like, here's my number. If you want to play, you know, whenever you start, you know, just text me and we'll play. So I played every Tuesday with Vijay for that whole season when we're in the same event.
Wow.
And I took a beating financially. We would always play the same. We would play $1,000 match play event, and you could press for half once you lost. And I beat him one time. No, I just take the beating for $1,000.
I was about to say, yeah. That'd be good sound financial advice.
I beat him one time. I birdied the last hole to shoot, like 62 or three at Nemacolin, which was an old event that's no longer on the schedule. And I beat him one up. So, he was winning 10 times a year, and then he was literally shooting like 66 or better every time on Tuesday, just beating me into the ground. But that was another invaluable experience for me to be around a guy who's playing that well, who at the time was a top 10 player in the world. I think he was number one, won the PGA that year, just to see how he practiced and what he did. And you get a real quick appreciation for where they're at and what he's doing, and then kind of like what you're doing. So
yeah, in the mirror situation.
Yeah. So I knew I needed to step it up. I needed to get better. And he gave me, he didn't really know what he was doing, but he was just doing it. You know what I mean? Which is another great quality of tour players. Like if you ask a lot of guys on tour, like, hey, how'd that happen? They have no idea. Mm-hmm. They just do it. Right. So I was able to take video and just kind of look and figure out and piece together, like, what's happening? How is this happening? And, you know, that was when they had the square grooves were still allowed and balls a little bit softer. But like he would do stuff around the greens that would just, you'd be like, yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, what'd you discover? Yeah. Did you discover anything from the video?
Well, he got a lot of that stuff from Seve, because he played a lot in Europe with Seve and Tom Pernice. And, you know, like some of the biggest thing for me with chipping is people want to stay in flexion too long and they don't want to get into extension. So when you go into extension, that really is a big shadowing piece with your upper body, right? If you watch Seve, he would tilt down and then he would come into extension. It's a huge, huge way to shallow. So you never get any turf. Like Vijay was always clipping these pitch shots, like on the tightest stuff you've ever seen, like clipping it like right off the bottom couple grooves. And that's how you get the most spin. There's no interaction with the turf. And the way to do that is with the extension piece. And then he had all these trick shots where he was basically cutting across it so much that he could put so much speed on it. And the smash would be low. So high speed is going to be high spin, but we don't want it to go far. So it's like a glancing blow, right? And he's putting this crazy, and you know, just all these little setup tricks. And like, if you watch anything with Seve, which is out on the internet, like you can piece it together pretty quick. And Vijay was doing all the same things.
And I've watched you hit wedge shots before, and I think you've described it as you like to feel like the ball is on the face a very long time. And so for bad wedge players, I you can always tell if you're right in front of them watching and you see this ball jump off the face and go up into the air. Most of the time, they're going to be a very good wedge player.
I launch so, low spin is not good for pitching and chipping and wedge play.
Explain the mechanics for you of how you feel low launch, high spin.
So a lot of it for me is club face angle on the takeaway. So Vijay had a pretty weak grip and he liked to have a lot of cup in his golf swing. And that's imperative, in my opinion, for chipping and pitching, because when the wrist is cupped and the toe is up and the face is more open, now I can use this flexion, this wrist angle and really lay that into it. And then I'm able to lean the shaft and do that. And if I have extension, then I'm not going to get diggy into the ground. So I'm getting that clean strike with a shallow compression. And that's how you really pick up the speed. But if you go back shut, you're not going to feel the loft.
Right.
And then a lot of people want to add the loft coming in. And what happens is this would be shut to open. That's what you want to try and avoid. You really want to have it open. And if you see, you know, like a lot of good short game guys, usually weak grips, open face. Luke Donald was really good at it. Tiger was really good at doing that in a short game, but the opposite in his full game. Jordan Spieth's been really good at it. JT does a great job varying between the two. But that's usually why guys that have a lot of good short game, because they usually play with these weak left wrists and open faces. That's great for short game and inside 30 it's yards. but it's terrible for your long stuff, right? So you got to be able to do opposite ends.
Trust me, I know.
And guys that can lean the shaft and compress it with their full swings generally struggle with putting and chipping too. There's balance of, can I do both, if that makes sense.
And I think the one other piece of this that I want to ask you about is wrist hinge on the way back with all of this in mind. Correct me if I'm wrong, you believe in a bit of width when you're hitting these, like, you know, wedge shots.
Yeah, I think it's very player dependent, because I see if guys do both ends, right? I think
Hideki, he hinges it. And then
I see guys like Jason Day and Steve Stricker. You know, no wrists, no elbows, but they roll their forearms forearms roll to get the face open. And then I see guys that look real wristy and hingy and like all this action.
Yeah.
And it's getting open. So I think you can go both ways with it. I think the main thing is that the face has to be getting open and toe up. I think like Rory does that in his golf swing a lot. And
he kind of has it shut and he picks it. Like,
and he's got this. He's got this in his short game and he's got it in his wedges. And that, you know, that's a tough one, but he does it. Some guys do it in their golf swings. So if you do it in your golf swing, it's going to be easy for you. But if you're a guy with a strong grip or a weak grip and you like to do this, it's harder. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense. And if you've been listening to all of this, we have to make sure that you go and watch the YouTube, as Duffner and I both have been doing a lot of things with our hands over the last about 10 minutes, describing all of these feels that we're talking about. One last question about VJ, because this is the story that I was supposed to ask. Did he ever on the fifth hole at Augusta try to hit like three woods out of that bunker to get enough topspin to roll it onto the green? Is this like a true story?
That's a true story. I've seen
him. Would he do it in the tournament too? Like if he hit it down in there?
I don't know if he's there, but I've seen him take a 3-iron and hit it as hard as he could into that face on number 5. And then it changes the spin. It would topspin out and it would land like 100 yards. And then all of a sudden it looked like he took a bouncy ball and threw it on concrete. And I'm like, what is that? And he's like, oh, bro, you got to have all these shots around here, bro. And I'm like, you're not trying that. And he's like, yeah, I'll try it. But I don't know if he did it in the tournament, but I have seen that him do that. He'll multiple times, like as hard as he can hit a 3-iron right into that big old lip. And then it's backspinning. Then when it hits, it changes over. And if he catches it like in the right spot, it gets enough launch to get over and it will land like 100 yards short. And then it have like you threw a tennis ball or a bouncy ball down on concrete and it just takes off.
Well, as somebody who's really good at hitting the lip in a fairway bunker, all I need to do is just start clubbing up more because it always ends up about 6 yards short. I need to go down and loft and hit 3-irons instead.
There's a lot of things with my time with him. Obviously, he's, you know, for that 10 years or however long his career was, but really 10 years where he played amazing. He's one of the best players to ever do it. And I was lucky to spend some time with him, but there's a lot of like what just happened moments with him, right? Where you're trying to wrap your mind around like what is he thinking, how does he do this, etc.
We had Kiz come on and he told a story about him chipping in at the Zurich Classic to win the golf tournament, and I was really just asking you about that because it was such a cool moment. But he had mentioned that earlier in the week that neither him or Scott Brown could not chip, and that you were just watching these two literally playing like hockey sticks around Zurich Classic and somehow win the tournament.
They were putting it from like Scott Brown had one from 40 yards on the 15th hole and he putted it like he's putting it the whole time. I'm like, I'm getting furious. And then we get to like our 33rd hole, which was the 6th hole at the time. And Scott hit it right behind this bunker and you had to go over the bunker to get to the pin. And Kiz was like, and I go, can't putt that one, can you? And then he just kind of pitched out over here, played it safe. And he's got him on, played safe.
My gosh.
I mean, that's the one thing is the chipping is not the most required skill on the tour. Like if you're a good chipper, it can help you, but you can get around not being able to chip and pitch the ball.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
Clearly, right. Because they won at Zurich.
Yes. And I had no idea that he absolutely boned his pitch shot and then it hits the pin and goes in, but yeah, that's a story for another day. Well, Duff, it's been a lot of fun. I got one more thing for you, Charlie, if you don't mind the Duffnering deal, because I had to go text all of my buddies. And I was like, does anybody have the photo of me and my friends Duffnering at Skybar? This is back in 2013 or 14, I think.
Yeah.
So, of course, we got a side-by-side picture if you're watching on YouTube. Yeah. But you can see us and the boys at Skybar. This is before, obviously, I'm on tour.
Yeah. I mean,
hey, it was a phenomenon. I mean, it's quite the position you got going there.
That looks like I had a rough night the night before.
Kind of looks that way to me too. And what's about the kids?
Yeah, they're making an adult sit on the floor, though. Like, I hate the floor. Like, I'm not a kid. Like, I don't have this flexibility anymore. And I don't know. They were telling a story or something, and I'm just, like, dying. My back is hurting. My hamstrings are cramping.
I could see that you're giving, like, a little hammy massage here.
And I'm like, when is this over? That's the other thing. Everybody thinks, like, that's the only thing I had to do. Like, I just rolled up to it like that. This is like 2.5 hours in to the media day that I was doing for Byron Nelson. Like, I'm over
it. Was this like a picture of somebody's cell phone, or was this like a picture they posted? Hey, Jason Duffner's here, and this is like the photo they ran.
This is some media guy trying to be a media guy and catch Duff in a bad light is what it was.
And, well, he got you.
He got me. But it turned out okay. I think I became more popular because of it.
Yeah. But did Tiger give you any grief? You know, you're wearing the red shirt, black pants, and you're trying to be like Tiger at a media day.
That's the outfit I wear on Mondays, not Sundays. That's my Monday outfit.
That's fair. That's fair.
But yeah, like, you know, there's always a story behind it, but I was probably out too late Sunday night, and then this is 2.5 hours in, and you're making a grown man sit on the floor, and, you know, I'm probably thinking about my agent is terrible. That's what I'm probably thinking right now. Why are we still here? But, you know, it worked out. People still like to talk about it. They want me to, like, reproduce it and replicate it, and I'm like, I'm good, man. It was just something that happened.
Do you want me to sit on the floor here in the airport, man? Like, do we really need to do this right now?
People do that still. I'm like, what are you doing? Get up off the ground.
Oh, man. But, all right, Duff, this has been great. We appreciate you coming on, man, and congrats, by the way, on getting inducted to the Alabama Hall of Fame. I saw that, earlier this year, so that's a pretty cool honor as well.
We went through that last we were there in Birmingham Friday and Saturday. Yeah, so it went
here's
well.
A picture right here. Congrats, man. That's awesome.
It's always nice as an athlete to be recognized for what you did and, you know, your contributions to the sport. So we had a nice time in Birmingham and got to hear the stories of the other inductees, and it was a good weekend.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate it. And if you want to maybe do a PGA Tour event together where you're hitting all the shots and I hit all the stuff in and around the green, I really think Jason Kaufman or Smiley Duffner really could have like a second leg here. Got some momentum.
We could work it out. We can work it out.
I'm looking forward
to the Champions Tour in a couple of years.
My man. Well, we're looking forward to watching you too.
Appreciate it.
All right, Duff. See you, buddy.
Thank you.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our first lovely time fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people on YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the...
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.